Okay. Okay, we are. I'm not gonna say what day of the Omer it is, but we're very close to Lag BaOmer.
So.
I am legally bound.
You can say one day.
Yeah, we are in range. We're in range of Lag BaOmer. And Lag BaOmer is an interesting holiday. It's a later one. It's kind of like a first cousin of the Chagim, if you think about it, because it's obviously not a biblical holiday. It's not a Hanukkah and Purim, but it's kind of like comes like, hey, can I come with? And there are those that Shalom Aleichem, Zach. There are those that take it extremely seriously, those that kind of let it pass and wonder what it was all about. What we know, hopefully, to some level, is that there is a mystical component to Lag BaOmer. We know that this day is tied very intimately to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was famously responsible for bringing much of the mystical hidden parts of the Torah out for the general public to learn and to experience, and that is something that is celebrated on this day. It is also famously the day, although this is disputed, the truth is, but according to many, the day that the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva who were dying from some supernatural plague stopped dying, and there is an element of joy in the fact that this plague stopped, although I'm not sure how much joy there is, but I think there is a reason to mark this day as a day where there's, we could exhale again, we could go back to normal, so to speak. And I must confess, the sources you'll see in front of you are not so Hasidish at all. At all, actually. And I know this is called Hasidus in the Parsha, so we're doing not Hasidus on not the Parsha today. Lies. And continuing in the theme. But I wanted to share some simple thoughts. Actually, ideas that, from thoughts that I had delivered partially here and in other situations, and never once did I think to connect the two until this week, connect the three, until this week, and it just came together and I felt the need to share it and see what you think, and if it makes no sense, it's my fault, and if it makes a lot of sense, it's my fault. Okay. Okay, let's start a little with curveball. Parshas Bahar, we just finished in this country. We just finished reading Parshas Bahar. Parshas Bahar starts with a very famous question by Rashi. The Parsha starts by the very source number one, the Bereshit Shemot Moshe, Bahar Sinai Lemor. Now, normally that pasuk goes, in almost every other situation, by the Bereshit Shemot El Moshe Lemor. And in this situation, the Torah, written by God, decided to add in two extra words, Behar Sinai, on Mount Sinai. And what did he say on Har Sinai? Debel b'nei Yisrael v'yamart alehem. He told Moshe to command the Jewish people about Kizavol al Aretz Asher Nidusein Lachem Mishavsa Haaretz Shabbos Lashem, that the land should keep Shabbos. And as you see in the Pesukim following, this is referring to the mitzvah of Shemitah, which we just observed last year. And Rashi famously asks on source number two, Bahar Sinai, Ma Inyan Shemitah Etzel Har Sinai. He points out the obvious question, which is, V'halo kol ha-mitzvos nemru mi-Sinai. All the mitzvos are given on Har Sinai. The very first mission in Pirkei Avos is Moshe Kibel Torah mi-Sinai. All of the Torah was given at Sinai. So why is this mitzvah singled out as in the pasuk as being taught, transmitted to us through Moshe from God on Har Sinai, if really all of them were? Why emphasize that fact here? Because again, it wasn't that this was the only mitzvah given in Har Sinai. It was even that all of them were, and none of them were mentioned, and this one was. And Rashi gives a very logical answer that we're using the tool of the Kal Vachomer, or Ma'an Af, actually. Just like this, so too that. Ma'ashmita nemrukulo sever pato sever dikto kea mi Sinai. Just like this one mitzvah of Shemitah, with all of its general rules and its details and its more minute details were given in Har Sinai, we can learn from this, so too, kulan, all of the other 612 remaining mitzvos were given not only the general rules and the details, but even the most minute points about each mitzvah were given at Har Sinai. That is from a Medrash, says Rashi. Now, I ask myself, okay, that's great, although you could have really just pulled this off with any mitzvah, right? Meaning, if the same thing happened by giving a divorce document, a get, that Hashem commanded Moshe and Har Sinai, you could ask the same question and give the same answer. Just like a get, a divorce document is given at Har Sinai with all the rules, so is there everything else. So it doesn't necessarily answer the Shemitah point. It just answers why Har Sinai was mentioned here and not everywhere else, because we're drawing from this one example and creating a rule for everything else. So there has to be something specific about Shemitah and what Shemitah represents, and Har Sinai, and what Har Sinai represents, that Hashem thought to bring these two ideas together. And the way I went about considering this point was by taking a step back and kind of envisioning what these two elements in Judaism represent. What does Har Sinai represent? First word that comes to your mind?
Torah.
Good. I tried that with a different group. It was like the fifth answer. Not sure why. I got like Moshe. I got flowers. It was weird. Whatever. What's the first word that comes to your mind when I say the word Shemitah? Very good. Awesome. That was perfect. I know there were some people ready to go with halacha. Okay, that's associated. Someone said wheat last time. I didn't take points off for that because that's technically a valid response. But Eretz Yisrael, right? Mitzvot tulis ba'aretz. This is kind of like the poster boy for, this is something that if you're in Israel, it's a big deal, and if you're outside of Israel, it's no deal. There is nothing that changes in your life. Shemitah could pass and nothing changed. Unless you're importing food, right? From Israel. But if you're in Israel, your whole life changes dramatically. Your bank account changes dramatically. Where you shop, people you hang out with. We were uninvited for a Shabbos meal because of our Shemitah laws. Whatever, long story. They invited us and were like, oh, by the way, we have to have this and that. Like, oh, maybe next year we'll invite you. It was funny, kind of like to hear that. Like, oh, maybe we'll invite you in another year. you don't usually... like maybe another week, but this time it was a whole year. So, it changes. Eretz Yisrael and Shemitah, you can't, right? They're one and the same. And what it made me realize is really the two elements at play here is the Torah and Eretz Yisrael. Because God, again, could have put this image of Har Sinai next to any mitzvah, but he chose Torah. Now, what makes this question a much bigger question, if you think about the nature of why God chose Shemitah to be given at Har Sinai, is because Shemitah wasn't even applicable at the time of Har Sinai. They were in a desert. Not only were they not in Israel, but they weren't even planting anything. They were living in a desert, in tents, and there was magical food coming out of the sky. No Shemitah. And not only that, but the people that were even at Har Sinai, who were hearing this, weren't even going to be the ones to do it when they got there to Israel, because they didn't even make it there. It was their kids. So there was a huge disconnect between the event of hearing the Mitzvah Shemitah and the people, the first people to actually observe the Mitzvah Shemitah. That's what makes the question stronger. So that is a way of understanding Rashi, if you look a little deeper into what Rashi is trying to say. Why is it such a good comparison, just like it was Shemitah was given at Har Sinai, so to everything else? Because you would think of all the mitzvahs, you didn't need to give the Shemitah one in Har Sinai. You could have given everything else that applied, and the stuff that didn't apply, give later when it's applicable. So too, everything else. Correct. But I want to ask an even bigger question that kind of is off the paper, and not necessarily the same exact question that Rashi is asking, but it's kind of based off of Rashi's question, which is, isn't it kind of strange that the way God set it up is that the Torah and Eretz Yisrael don't inherently have a connection, that we kind of have to like figure out how they are connected? It's true, big question marks everywhere. But there are some, I hear that, and at the same time, there's some things that God intended to be incredibly clear. Right? God gave the Torah at Har Sinai. That wasn't a mystery. Where is Har Sinai already? You're at a mystery. But God gave the Torah to us at Har Sinai. We were all there. No mysteries there. Right? Some things he wanted to be incredibly clear. And this one point, the promised land and the Torah, there is an inherent connection. He obviously opted for a different version other than giving the Torah in Eretz Yisrael, which would have been very understandable if the story went that way, right? I'm going to take you out of Egypt, I'm going to march you through the desert, I'm going to bring you into Eretz Yisrael, we're going to go to the holiest place on earth, it's going to be the craziest, coolest thing in the holiest. Instead, it's a random mountain that we'll never know where it is, and it's in a desert, right? I would have totally accepted the other script, where they go to Harabai and get the Torah there. And it's not that way. And now you have to, now Zionism is something separate from the Torah, and now there are people that could be Zionists that don't have anything to do with Torah, and why is that? Think about it. If Torah and Eretz Yisrael were literally inseparable on paper, it would really be much harder to have such a thing as secular Zionism.
We also have a much harder time of having religious life outside of...
Right. So there's clearly a path that God chose, where Torah not being symbolized only as inside of Eretz Yisrael was very important, because he kind of knew the end of the story, which is thousands of years living outside of Eretz Yisrael. And if we couldn't relate to a Torah that existed outside of Eretz Yisrael, then maybe we wouldn't be around to talk about it right now. So yes, there is definitely two sides to this. But in my search to find the connection between Eretz Yisrael and the Torah, there was one that jumped out in the text itself. Something that connected the two. Air source in here, slowly. Yeah, thank you. And it's in the next two sources. And it's a word that is used in Chumash only two times, referring to only two things, and no other place is this word used in the five books of Moses, and it is only referring to Eretz Yisrael and the Torah. And that word is Morasha. We know if we went to Hebrew school as a child. Right. Torah tziva lanu Moshe, Morasha kilat Yaakov. It's at the very end of Sefer Devarim. Right, Torah tziva lanu Moshe. What is that Torah? A morasha for the kihilot of Yaakov. For the kihila of Yaakov. Right, morasha. What does that word mean?
Morasha is
inheritance. That would be inheritance. Good.
Why?
You were gonna go slightly different.
The little Yerusha after.
What?
Isn't
Yerusha inheritance? Good. You guys are on the ball. Where?
It says it right there. Marasha below
Yerusha. Oh, you're talking about source number 5. Correct. Correct. I'm going to get to that. That's the springboard for the next point. But Marasha is very closely connected to the word Yerusha. It's the same root. It just has a mem in the front. We're going to have to figure out what that means. Are you searching for the right English word?
For Marasha.
I think the heritage is the
heritage.
Word you're looking for. Yes. Which, does anyone want to define what heritage means? Because it's very similar to inheritance. If you think about it,
heritage is usually something not physical and more of a guide, like you.
Like a tradition.
Yeah,
sure.
Heritage, where you're from.
Right, right. I guess you could make that distinction. Something physical, property based, as opposed to something more cultural or ethnic or religious. Very good. Although, what's interesting is we're talking about Torah, and then the word that's being used. Oh, I guess you're saying Morasha is like a Moreshet as opposed to like a Yerusha. And I guess it's a good question. Which one is it? Or is it both? Is it neither? Right. Now, where do we see that Morasha is referring to Eretz Yisrael? In the beginning of Parshas Va'era, where God very famously declares the four Lashonos, the Arba Lashonos of Geula, Vehotzeiti, Vehitzalti, Vegaalti, Velakachti, and then there's the fifth one, Veheveti. Shmot Perek Vav, Veheveti Etchem El Haaretz Asher Nasati Es Yadi, Latet Otel Avraham Litzak Liyakob Natati Otel Achem Morasha Ani Hashem. I'm going to give it to you as a Morasha. Now this is clearly referring to land. Ain't no arguing that. A land that will be a Morasha, a Torah that will be a Morasha. And again, no other element in the entire Torah is called this word. So, impossible not to see the two as connected in some way. So, the Rabbeinu Bechaya makes an interesting point, a Rishon, about this word Morasha. And he does refer to the point that we made before about the generation that was receiving this. Now he's referring to the land of Israel. This is even before they're at Har Sinai. Referring to the fact that these people weren't going to even go into Eretz Israel. So here's what he says. Source number 5. Morasha velo Yerusha. It's not a Yerusha, not an inheritance. Lirmo shelo yu yorshim wasa. It's not that they were going to be inheriting it. Lefisha atidin hayu yotze mitzrayim lamus bamidbar. This generation of Jews were going to die in the Midbar. They weren't even going to enter Eretz Yisrael. Aval yu morishim ota levneihem. Do you guys now know what the word morasha is? It's kind of strange. But it actually doesn't mean to inherit something, but to pass on an inheritance to someone else, to the next generation. So it's kind of weird, and if you think about it, if the Jews at that time understood what God was saying, it's kind of a bummer. But God was saying, I'm going to give you this land, not for you, to hand over to your kids. Which is foreshadowing the fact that they're not going to make it there.
That's rough.
Yeah. And their children will enter the land, and not them. And he makes this connection. The same word, the same idea, the same concept should be applied to Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe by the Torah. V'lo Amar Yerusha. Ki haya b'mashma shahatorah lo tihiye Yerusha. Ki im la oso hador shakibluah bilvad. If it's called a Yerusha, it kind of implies that it's meant to be used and benefited from by that generation, by that those people that are getting it right now. But that is not the point. V'al kein Amar Morasha shatzarech lehorisha livnehem. That you need to pass it on as a heritage to their children. Kinyan shekasev v'shinantem levanecha. And this is a fascinating point. What is the source? Kind of gave it away, but think about it for a second. What is the source in the Torah that it is an obligation to learn Torah?
Shema.
What do you mean, the word Shema?
No.
What's the pasuk?
V'shinantem levanecha.
What do those words mean? And you should teach them to your children, v'dibartem, and you should speak in it. Now think about this. The source of the Torah that you have to learn Torah comes from the pasuk, you need to teach it to your kids, which means there is no real source in the Torah that you have to learn. There's only a source in the Torah that you have to teach. But the only way to teach, obviously, is if you go through a whole bunch of day school and high school and yeshiva and whatever. And then you learn it, and now, once you're ready to teach it, you'll have something to teach. But all of that until that point, technically, according to the Bible, is only preparation for the actual mitzvah. Now you're getting the mitzvah.
It's like mitzvah, it's like it should be time. Same idea. You don't technically have the idea of knowing it, you have the idea of passing it on.
Correct. You got it to Levincha. Right? But it's strange, because one would think there should be an individual obligation to know, to have, to acquire it. And yet there isn't. Now, I'm not entirely accurate, because in Navi, there is a mitzvah derabbanan of learning Torah, which is the pasuk that most people put on that wooden shtender present that they bring their older brother home from Israel. V'higisa bo yomam v'layla. That is, learn Torah, buddy. Right? That's what that mitzvah says. That has nothing to do with your kids, but that's in the Navi. That is not in the Torah, in the Chumash.
Wait, so according to the Torah, once you pass it on, you're good? You're set?
Well, it's kind of hard to pass it all on to the point where you're good.
Okay, not all of it.
But
it's all of it. That's the.
You're supposed to.
Yeah.
You're supposed. What?
No.
Okay. The obligation is to give your child a Torah education. It's a good question in terms of the parameters. When is that obligation finished? Perhaps when they become an adult? Hard to know. But the Rabbeinu Bechai points out a very important point, which is the Torah is not meant to be understood as an individual set of laws and instructions and ideas meant for you to consume. Think about it that way. It's not meant for you to take and incorporate into your life and then it just disappears into you. No, it's meant to be something that continues afterwards, and it's almost like you're the keeper of it. And it's not about you. It's about him. Now, what's ironic is it's not about him either. Right? It's about his kid and her kid. And it's about. And it's never about anyone in the end. Right? Or you could say it's about everyone.
So curious who that last person's going to be.
Right. Yeah, it's like the whole thing was because of this little guy. Right? So this is a fascinating point where Rabbeinu Chai really... First, he obviously draws this connection between Torah and Eretz Yisrael. What connects the two? Not necessarily their nature, but how they are meant to be used or understood. They are not meant to be consumed, acquired by any one individual. They are meant to be protected, kept, developed in some way, and carried on through the individual so that they can be passed on in their complete form to the next generation. And that is the same obligation for each and every generation. That is the way that Torah and Eretz Yisrael are connected. We're not anywhere near Lag BaOmer yet, but we'll get there. Now what's fascinating about this, and this is speaking off the paper, is the word Morasha is a combination of Yerusha and Moreshet. Yerusha is something that you receive from the generation in front of you, behind you, I mean. And Moreshet is something that you're passing on, right? The whole nature of a heritage is that it's never ending, that it's supposed to be passed on. And what's fascinating is those two processes are almost never taking place at the same time. If you're inheriting something, that means you're alive and the people before you are no longer living. For the most classic form of inheriting a property. If you're passing something on, that implies that you're no longer living, or you're no longer fit for whatever you have, and you're passing it on. Those typically don't happen at the same time, because one implies that you're around and you're fit to keep this, and one implies that you're not anymore. Right? So it's kind of like a process that doesn't make sense in reality. You're never receiving and passing on at the same time. That means like you're invisible, that you're irrelevant. Perhaps that's why this concept doesn't exist anywhere else, because it's not a real world concept of being someone that receives something but only as a way of passing it on, because it implies that there's no significance in your handling of it. But that's not the case. The only two things that this concept can be understood properly is in the case of Eretz Yisrael and in the case of Torah, where you are supposed to develop a life of Torah, and ideally in Eretz Yisrael, for those generations where that's even possible. And it is not only for the sake of you receiving it from your kids and you being the focus of... Sorry, you receiving it from your parents, and you are the focus of what they did. They developed this whole Jewish home. They had their Shabbos table. They spent thousands upon thousands of dollars, depending on what country you're from, and if this happened to you, on Jewish education. All of that was so that you would absorb this stuff. And at the same time, the second part of it was so that you would develop into this person and do the same thing. And that is a two-sided process that's constantly happening. Anytime you're in a room learning Torah, you're learning it because your parents are providing you, either they are sponsoring it or they're teaching you in the room, or they gave you the upbringing to want to be in that room. And therefore, it is them that is bringing you to this room. And at the same time, you're doing this thinking, this is not about me, this is about my kid eventually having this experience, perhaps in an even greater way than me. And therefore, ironically, whenever you're in a present moment when it comes to Eretz Yisrael and Torah, it's really only about the past and the future, and not as much about the present. It's kind of a weird thing, out of body type of thing. You are representing two different generations every time you're connecting in some way to Torah and Eretz Yisrael. You're representing the people before you and the people that are going to come from you. You're their messenger. This idea, I realized recently, is very beautifully explained by Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch on the mitzvah of Kibbutz Aveim, which is a shiur that I gave a couple years ago here on Kibbutz Aveim, regarding a very famous question about one of the Ten Commandments, the fifth one, Kabed es avich v'yasimecha. What is the famous question about Kabed es avich v'yasimecha? It's location. It's the fifth commandment. Now we know that the Ten Commandments were separated into two tablets of stone, and each tablet represented one aspect of our religious life. One was what? Bein Adam L'Makom, our relationship with God, as seen through the Torah. And the other half was Bein Adam L'Chaver, our relationship with fellow man. And that's why if you think about the second tablet, the second of the Luchos, there's don't steal, don't kill, don't bear false witness, don't be jealous, right? All things that have nothing to do with God, really, directly, but all have to do with the way you relate to other people. And if you look at the first of the Luchos, you see, I am God. Don't worship other idols. Don't say my name in vain. Keep the Shabbos. And then there's this weird one. Honor your parents. Honor your parents is on the first side with all the God stuff. And yet, it's God telling you to do something that has nothing to do with Him, but has to do with your parents. So it's the odd man out here. It doesn't make sense. Either we should split them up to 4 and 6, or you got to replace number 5 with one that has to do with God, but this one doesn't. So why does Kabed es avich v'yasimecha, why is it located, why was it situated in the first of the Luchos? Now, there is a famous answer, which may be already coming to your mind, even if you've never heard it before, which is, God didn't make parents by accident. He created a system where parents and children relate to each other, and that children always have to have some sort of authority figure that contains both elements of love and respect in them, right? That dynamic, which exists everywhere, except for obviously exceptional cases where the relationship breaks down. But the standard form of that relationship, which is authority figure that you love and at the same time respect, that is a perfect parallel to the way we were meant to relate to God.
Fear also.
Right. Ishimova aviv tira'u, kabed es avicha v'yasimecha. So there's clearly a relationship there in terms of how we relate to our parents and how that is meant to kind of train us to when we are mature enough to start thinking bigger than that and think about how we are meant to relate to God. Well, we already have a perfectly working model in place for how that relationship is meant to be. And think about how difficult it would be if we didn't have the context of parenthood to draw from to see, okay, well, how do I relate to this God? Well, in some way I had someone that controlled my life and supported my life and loved me and took care of me and also disciplined me when necessary. So that's a very good and usually the first answer that's brought to answer this question. But Rav Hirsch gives a totally different answer, and it's beautiful, and it's innovative. It just kind of captures something that you would, that in my mind, I shouldn't speak for others, I wouldn't have immediately thought of. I'm going to read it inside, even though he wrote his Peirush in German, and it was translated into Hebrew and English. It's beautiful. Yitzias Mitzrayim, source number 7, Umatan Torah, Heim Shtei Ovdot HaYisod Shel Am Yisrael. Right? Exodus and the giving of the Torah, two of the most basic fundamental elements of Am Yisrael. Sha'alein tichon k'niyaseu lefnei Hashem k'moshel v'shalit b'goraleinu u'b'chayinu. These are the two events where we base our understanding of our humility and our need to place God as our ruler, as our leader, as our God over us and our lives. V'hine shtei ovdot eile ovdot historiotein. These are two events that are historical in nature. V'anu yodinos anu makir v'hen kamisas historios. We understand them as real, factual events that took place. Ulam, but, and here's where it gets interesting. Ha'aruva ha'yechida la'amitotan hi ha'misoret. The way that we bring these two events into our life and make them, incorporate them into our reality, I'm translating loosely, the way that we bring a historical event into our real life that is happening here now is through tradition, through the passing on of tradition. Not just that we read it in a textbook or a Bible in this case, and we try and think what it might have been like, and maybe we look at some pictures, some drawings of what it would look like, and maybe we read a few midrashim, other stories that color the picture, but we actually hear mouth to mouth from people who heard it from other people, who heard it from other people eventually who were there. The Yisoda shel Mesoras Eino Ela Mesirasa HaNe'eman Elevanim Midei HaAvos. And the foundation of tradition is only from the faithful transmitting to children from their parents. And the Kibalta Baratzon Bidei HaBanim Midei HaAvos. And the willingness of those children to receive that tradition from their parents. It's a two-way street. The parents need to feel like I need to give it over to my kids, and the kids need to feel like I probably need to listen to what they're saying, or else this doesn't work, right? If the parents are like, this isn't really so important, so kids could want to hear it, but they won't, because it won't exist in their Shabbos table. And if parents are talking, they're saying, son, I have something really important to say, but kids feel no need to listen, then obviously it will break down, if not right then, and then eventually. So there needs to have this feeling of urgency, both on the parent side and the kid side, to absorb this tradition and to transmit it. And basically what Rav Hirsch says is, this is the goal of the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em. If you don't have a Torah obligation to respect your parents, then when they decide to say, son, I need to teach you something important, it's up to you if you listen to them or not. If they say, you know, back when I was a kid, I put on tzitzis. Well, if you don't care what he did when he was a kid, because it doesn't matter to you, it's not relevant, it's not an obligation, so then you decide the way you live. It doesn't matter what they did. Tradition isn't relevant if your parents aren't relevant, aren't necessary, I would say. So having it as a mitzvah obligation, as a Torah obligation, means that when they're telling me something important, like, here, son, here's your tradition, you need to keep this, you need to guard this, this is from generations ago, and it's now my turn to pass it to you, you will now say, whoa, whoa, wait, this is a really big deal. This is one of the Ten Commandments. I need to listen to what he's saying. This mitzvah is actually the foundation of Torah being passed on from generation to generation, our faith being passed on from generation to generation. Without this, there would be no relationship with God. Because God would be a story. He wouldn't be a reality. And in order to do that, God created a system where you need human beings to ensure that your relationship with God remains relevant and real. Through the mitzvah of Kaberes Avicha V'Yasimech. And if you'll see the underlines in the end of 7, Keshem She'enei HaBen El Horav Kein Tihiyena Elav Enei Yiladav Bevo Azman. And just like the eyes of the children of the son will be towards his parents through this commandment of Kibud Av V'Em, so too his children's eyes will be on him when the time is right. Very poetic. Ilmalei hakasher bein avos ubanim. Without this inherent and obligatory connection between fathers and sons, tinutak sharsheret hadorot. The chain across all generations will be broken. Inevitably. Naturally it will be. The hope of the Jewish history, the Jewish past, in bringing that past to the future and to the Jewish nation, that hope is gone. Because if one generation kids stop thinking they need to listen to their parents, then the next generation after that, there's nothing to teach. Because those kids will grow up to be parents and feel no need to teach that tradition that they got to their kids. By the way, this one point, and this isn't the point of the shir, there's only an element of it. This one point is probably one of the most integral things in Jewish life that is in danger right now. Because Western culture preaches out with the old and with the new. Version 2.0 is always better than version 1.0. Which means kids are growing up, and it's not a lesson that they're learning from school. It's something that they're seeing. They're learning from life, which is, I probably know more about this world than my parents do. They're learning that about technology when their parents are like, how do I send one of those text messages, right? And you're like, boop, just do that. Just press that one thing, right? And 10-year-olds know how to do it. That connection where I need to listen to what my parents say is breaking down, clearly. It's in danger. And it's this commandment that is keeping things together, assuming we could continue to keep it together. Now, what does any of this have to do with Lag BaOmer? That was a pretty long introduction, yeah, block, right? Finally, we get to source number 8. Now I'm going to make my case. Source number 8, famous Gemara about Rabbi Kiva and his Talmidim, like we said, one of the events that intimately connect to the day of Lag BaOmer. Masechus Yevamos Amavez Amavez Amru, 12,000 Zugim Talmidim Hayu Lo LeRabbi Akiva. Rabbi Kiva had 12,000 pairs of students, 24,000 students. By my count, that's a pretty darn big yeshiva. V'chulan mesu b'perek echad. They all died in one small period of time, the one that we are almost over with, the period of time between Pesach and Lag BaOmer. V'fnei shelo nahagu kavod ze lazeh. It's a weird phrase for many reasons. The Torah gives a specific reason why 24,000 people died within 30 days, which was clearly a supernatural thing, clearly divinely sent, a plague. It wasn't that everyone in the town was dying, it was that only people learning in this group were dying. Because they didn't, I'm just going to translate the Hebrew words, they didn't ascribe honor, they didn't behave in an honorable way one to the other. They didn't give honor.
Respect.
Yeah, respect. They didn't respect one another. Why did I try all those other ones? Should have just said that one. Whatever. Okay. And then the end of the Gemara talks about how there were only 5 students left. Luckily, there were 5 pretty good ones. Although they say they weren't at the top of their class. They were just the 5 that were left. And who were the 5 that were left? Rabbi Meir, Stam Mishnah, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Huda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon. Spoiler alert, we're talking about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Lazar ben Shemua. Behem Hem Hamid the Torah Sasha. They were literally the 5 people left on earth to uphold the tradition of the Torah and pass it on to the next generation. That is called no pressure, right?
Those were the only students learning at the time?
No, but they were the only students left of Rabbi Akiva. And if you started with 24,000 and you're left with 5, that means they have a big job to do. Lots of shoes to fill. But what is this whole idea of Shalot Nagu Kavod Zebazah? Because what we're talking about at Lag BaOmer, and forgive me if I fail to even attempt to talk about the mystical side of Lag BaOmer in my Chassidus shir, as I mentioned in the introduction, going more practical this time. But what is it about this day where this plague of not giving honor one to the other, not respecting one another, stopped, and we single out this day as a day where they stopped doing that, or the consequences of them not doing that ceased? And there's some connection here, therefore, to respecting one another, or to understanding the importance of respecting one another, right? It's kind of like today was the day that God thought, okay, they got it now. They learned their lesson. Or I don't need to keep pushing the point anymore. There are different ways of understanding what Shalom Nahagu Kavod Zela says. And you could try and think of in your mind what the dynamic was, what the atmosphere was among these people. And you could probably paint several different types of pictures. You could look at it as, you know, when someone would be learning and they would drop their pen, no one would feel the need to pick it up for them. Okay. You could do it as kind of this war, one for the other, who's better than who, and kind of putting each other down, which you may see in certain situations where when everyone's involved in the same thing, like a graduate school, it gets competitive, it gets cutthroat, there's competition, there are people undercutting each other. I remember hearing about a certain graduate school in business that if you went to the library or that, but I don't want to say which one, maybe someone was in it, or it doesn't even matter, it's Lashon Hara, kind of ironic to start doing that in this year. But I heard that if you'd go into the library of that business school, graduate school, and you would try and take out the textbooks that you would need to learn for the assignments and tests, that the pages would be missing that you would need in order to do that. And it's not because there are certain students that needed the pages, it was because they realized that if they take the pages from the library and there are kids that don't have the books themselves, then they're going to get a worse grade on that test, which means that the people that do have the book will get a better grade or be looked at as better and may get the job, right? So that might be the picture that is being painted here. And there are even several other possible different shades of what is it. But it's a good question. What was going on here? We're talking about the elite, right? The religious elite. So we're either talking about a situation where people are morally corrupt, where they're just vile people to each other. There's cold, mean people to each other, even though they spend their entire day learning Torah. Or the picture could be extremely different. And I heard it only recently said one way, totally not related to the ideas we just spoke about, but it clicked. It something happened. And I'm like, that's it. I heard it explained, and I really want to remember where I heard this explained or read this, but I don't remember right now. Was that they didn't, it wasn't, if you walked into the Beis Medrash of 24,000 people, there wasn't this like tenseness, there was no bad chemistry, there was no undercutting, there was no looking over your shoulder. It was a beautiful, nice place. If you were going there to try and get like the dirt and post it on social media, like what's going on here, you wouldn't see it. It wouldn't jump out at you. So what is this talking about? It's saying that they didn't respect the other people's process, the goal of what they were doing here. They saw their job as Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva as a purely individual one. One where this is about me. Now, not to the point where they were necessarily disrespecting others, but it was simply a singular activity. I'm learning Torah. That person's here, but he is here because he's helping me learn Torah. And it could be that I'm helping him. That's fine. But what I'm doing here is that I am trying to acquire Torah for myself. That is why I am here. Maybe there's a motive of me becoming the next Rabbi Akiva. There was a lot of pressure here. We're talking about these were the only people. There were a few other groups. All the people in the Talmud, it's weird because it kind of paints a picture of everyone learning Talmud. But the people in the Talmud are the only people learning Torah in the world. That's who we're talking about. So there's a lot of pressure to be great, to remember everything, to understand everything. And they saw their endeavor, the job that they had before them of learning Torah, as a singular one. One that was not connected to the people before them, the people after them, even the people across from them in the same room. This is about me. And it was simply the fact that they didn't see that this process involved other people. And that it wasn't just about them. It was enough for God to say, not necessarily that they're punished, that their crime was so bad that they need a severe punishment as to be murdered, to be killed off in a plague. It was that if you are going to be the people that are going to transmit the Mesorah, to give over this Torah to the next generation, and yet as you are acquiring this Torah, you have no sense of your place in this chain, because this is about you, the people in the room today, and not about the past, and not about the future, and not about anyone else but you, then you are not fit to pass on the Torah. You are not the type of person that I need to do this job. You may be doing it, but it's all wrong. If you're thinking that this is about you, here's the honest truth. It was never about you. And it never will be. It was about them before you, and it's about them after you. But it was never about you. And that goes for everyone, at all times. It's never about you. And I think the idea of Shalom Nagu Kavod Zebezeh might give a tiny bit of an opening to see that maybe they got a little too self-centered about this process, to the point where they began to ignore who this was about, for real. And if the whole point is eventually you need to teach this to someone because they're going to get older and they're going to realize it's about the next generation, they might not appreciate that process to the point where it will properly be transmitted. They might not see the importance of them doing what they did in order to give to them. They might see that they were more important than the next generation. Maybe those kids and their rock and roll music, what do they know? When we did it back in our day, we knew how to learn. Maybe that process of teaching and learning won't be in the highest possible quality that it needs to be. It's a suggestion. But perhaps what Lag BaOmer is about and by the way, it's not a coincidence that the Karban HaOmer is, which what we're doing this time is we're counting Sfiras HaOmer, which is tied to the Karban that was given at the beginning of these 49 days, and it counts up to the next Karban that is given, which are very Israel-centered activities. This is an Israel-centered occasion or period of time. And yet in the middle of it, we're talking about Rabbi Kiva and his students, and what are we leading up to exactly? Shavuos, the time of Matan Torah, of the Torah. So if we're talking about a time where we left Mitzrayim on our way to Matan Torah, on our way to Eretz Yisrael, and we're in the midst of the holiday or the joyous time, ironically, of Sfiras HaOmer, where we give the Karban HaOmer in Eretz Yisrael and are counting the days till we give the Mincha Chadasha, this brand new amazing Karban, which signifies also that we can eat all of the new crops in Eretz Yisrael. This whole process is talking about Eretz Yisrael, and that whole process is also equally at the same time leading up to giving the Torah. Again, a very interesting comparison. This very Israel-related, agricultural-related process going on at the same time as a Torah-related process of reaching the highest level of purity and preparing ourselves properly, which is what we talked about last week, to receive the Torah. So we have to keep in mind, as we get to Lag BaOmer, the day where we're kind of in the middle, it's a good spiritual stop sign, we could get to that time where we remember, okay, these are nice things, and there's a lot of individual introspection looking in, and what am I about, what am I for? Last week we talked about the importance of scrutinizing and evaluating, calculating our own character, and that's a very individual process. And the whole point of Sfiras HaOmer, and we mentioned even halachically that you can't be yotzei from someone else saying Sfiras HaOmer for you, is because the process of Sfiras HaOmer, of taking each day and evaluating your character, is a very individual one. At the same time, we have to remember that Eretz Yisrael and Matan Torah, that having this land and that learning and leading this life is not only about us. And I want to end with two practical stories regarding this point. Personal stories. One is about me and one is about an event I attended this morning. I grew up in New Jersey and parents were extremely Zionistic, but not to the point where there was any talk about moving here. It was more of an ideal. We weren't vacationers altogether, but that also meant that we didn't come to Israel often. My parents actually didn't want me to come to Israel until I was mature enough to appreciate it. Luckily, I convinced them to let me go after the summer after sophomore year, which is like when it's trendy to go for that summer.
Kolo.
The last one in Alon Shvut. And I'm glad that I convinced them because I really do think I appreciated it then on a 15-year-old level. And then I came to Israel and I learned the yeshiva for 2 years and I fell in love, but not like like I'm going to go learn, you know, to a kibbutz and just like forget life. I went back to New York and I did college, but I told myself I'm going to make it back. Now, it's weird because I really wanted to. I really believed myself that I'm going to try and do it. But I was totally afraid of what if that actually happens and I leave my whole life behind. Like, I don't know if I really want that, but I'm pretty sure I do. And I did it. And here I am. And that's why we're talking in this room right now. It's pretty amazing. But what's cool is the plain letter that my dad gave me. The plain letter that my dad gave me on my Aliyah flight made one very simple point. And it was that his parents, who escaped Europe before World War II, before it even started, and developed their own lives separately in America, each individually, and they were from very different families, actually one Hasidish and one Litvish, each of those two people, my grandfather and my grandmother, as single people, decided they're going to go to Eretz Yisrael. For one of them, it was very out of character because she was a Bianer Chassid in the Lower East Side, which is where Bianer Chassidus was. The Bianer Rebbe grew up in her neighborhood. She remembers him playing as a child. The one that is the Bianer Rebbe now, from the Lower, he's the American, he's from the Lower East Side. And it was very out of character to just get up and go to pre-Medina Israel, Israel. Just see what, there was nothing
to...
It wasn't that they were against, is that there was nothing there for them, exactly. There was no purpose of going. There was no overemphasis on Zionism just for the sake of it. It was out of character, let's say. And for my grandfather, he kind of, you know, his family was kind of in pieces, but he decided to go. They ran into each other, want to try and get to the point. They ran into each other in Israel and decided they liked each other and got married in Israel. I actually didn't know that until much later in my life. And then they decided to go back to America to get a degree to professionalize whatever it is they wanted to do so that they could eventually, not too much later, return to Israel so they could make a living and live here. My grandfather majored in chicken farming at Ohio State University for that reason. I didn't know that that was a major, but it is. I'm not sure if it's still around. He wanted to work in a kibbutz, but he wanted to have a degree to show for it, so it would be professional. They never made it back. They stayed the rest of their life in America. I never even knew that they were married in Israel. I never even knew that they wanted to go back to Israel. Didn't come up. I was also the youngest grandchild of theirs, so I was kind of like not in the know as much. But my father in that letter, as I was doing the whole nefesh b'nefesh flaggy excited thing, wrote, their dream is being fulfilled right now. They didn't make it back. Their grandkids are making it back. Mazal tov, thanks for living out their dream. Now, obviously, I became very emotional at that moment, as I'm trying to make sure I don't do right now. But I realized that this Israel thing wasn't about me so much at that moment. It was about a dream that existed two generations ago that didn't get fulfilled. And yeah, somehow I had this crazy thought in my head, let me just drop everything, come here and let's see what happens. But really, this was about living out someone else's dream that came before me, that passed it through my parents, and they didn't even get to live out the dream, and now I am. And then I get here, and I find out what life is really like here, to like live life here, and I'm still happy and it wouldn't change a thing, don't worry. But I realize that a lot of the adjustment period is so difficult for someone who's married and having kids and is American still. Can't ignore that. I am constantly in a state of adjusting to a new culture and a new society. And I find that most of the decisions that I'm making about where to live and what schools and and what type of home and what type of friends is mainly focused on what do I want my kids to be like when they become adults, or as they become adults, and they're going to be Israelis because they were born here and they're here. And I realized that my coming here had to do with my grandparents, and my living here has to do with my kids. And it guided my decision to get on a plane to get here, and it's guiding my decisions as I live here. And I feel like it's impossible to ignore that that is the concept of Morasha, the concept of living out a dream from your previous generations, and in order to pass on that dream to later generations. And I saw, now that's an ongoing process, one that has already taken several years. But I saw that process take place in around 30 days this morning, because there's a family that lives here in Givat Shmuel. They met Eliyah a year and a half, almost 2 years ago. They actually didn't even know where Givat Shmuel was on a map and didn't see their apartment, but they knew they wanted to come to Israel, and they knew that they had a job in Tel Aviv, so they just said sign something in Givat Shmuel. Pretty amazing. We know them, my wife and I know them through mutual friends. We became very friendly here. They're sweetest in the world. Unfortunately, the wife of this family, the mother, they came with three kids. The wife's father became ill with cancer several months ago. And suddenly, because it wasn't that there was a deterioration to the point where it was critical over Pesach, but on Chol HaMoed Pesach he passed away. And it was very shocking. And it was obviously much earlier than anyone was ready to let him go. And she was stuck, not able to sit Shiva yet because they had to bury him on Chol HaMoed. And when someone dies on a holiday, you have to wait till after the holiday to start sitting Shiva. Then she had to sit Shiva after that. And her family came from America, and they ended up staying for the entire Shiva and a little afterwards. So she wasn't only sitting Shiva, but she was hosting family in her house. And to top it off, she's 9 months pregnant during this whole time. A week ago, she had a baby boy. And this morning, she named that baby boy after her father. Now, I just saw this whole idea just like jump out and punch me in the face, where there was a person who was standing there, and every time I was looking at them, I'm just like, what is going on in their heads? The past, the present, the future is just all in front of them right now. Her father was alive 30 days ago, and not even 30 days ago, and is gone. Her newborn son, it's their first son after three girls, is in front of them with the same name as the father who was just around a month ago. And all you look at when you see this baby is the future. And they're standing there within 2 years of making Aliyah in Eretz Yisrael, giving a bris milah and starting the Jewish life of this boy. And it was two people living a world where this whole moment was about bringing something that was gone and in the past to the present moment. But at the same time, it wasn't really about the eight-day-old boy. It was about that boy's future and what that boy is going to bring into the world, and obviously in Eretz Yisrael. And it was just the visual to take it in what was amazing. And I just had a bagel and sat at the table there, but I was just looking at him just like, oh my God, this is it. So I have no practical advice for this idea, because it's a very impractical thought. It's one where most of the work is done kind of in an out-of-body way. At the same time, like I mentioned, my own personal life, there's a lot that can be incorporated into the way you're doing things, not just what you're doing, but the way you're doing things when you realize, especially as young adults who have decided to make their life in Eretz Yisrael, that this isn't only about you. It's about the dreams of other people, whether they're your own parents or grandparents or cousins, whether they're alive or not alive, but we're also talking about generations before. About Gedolim, who said, I would give my entire life just to take one step in Eretz Yisrael, famously Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who his whole life would write poems about Eretz Yisrael, and he finally, at the end of his life, he got here. If you heard of the story, I'm rambling, I'm sorry, I need to finish this. Finally, he got the money, he said, I'm leaving my life, and back in the day, he lived in the Middle Ages, like Rambam time. when you leave Eretz Yisrael, it's just a farewell. You don't like go back for Pesach to Spain, right? That doesn't happen. And he got to Eretz Yisrael, this place that he's been dreaming about, gets there, gets off his horse, kisses the ground, and gets trampled by a chariot that's driving by. He got 5 moments in Eretz Yisrael, the place he loved. But that's a dream, and that's the person that got there. And we're living out dreams. Every moment that we're here, we're living out hopes and dreams of thousands of people and hundreds of generations. And to belittle that by saying, "Yeah, I'm just a dude trying to, you know, eat a shawarma and pay my bills." Yeah, that's what we're doing practically, all of us, in one way or another. But at the same time, this is the wildest dream of many hundreds of people, generations of people. And at the same time, if you're like me, you're thinking not just about your kids necessarily, but about building a place that will be a better Israel for the people that are still waiting to come. That if I could do something good here, if I can make this, even if there's someone who knows that I'm here and they're friends with me, or knows, or would hear about people like me that live in Israel, oh, those type of people live here? And by the way, I do recruitment and marketing for, you know, international students. And when they hear, oh, there's community of students like me that live here, oh, okay, I could do it. And that might be the difference between someone who makes a whole life here and someone who doesn't, and that's because there are people like you in this place. And it's an amazing thing to think about how what you're doing every day is bridging that past with the future. And hopefully more people will decide to be crazy dreamers like us, enough that when Mashiach comes, he won't need to even bring anyone here, won't be here. But if that's not the case, so then hopefully God's watching what we're doing here, and he's saying enough is enough. Maybe Lag BaOmer is a good day to call it, just to say, okay, everyone, huddle up, Eretz Yisrael, it's time to go. And it should be speedily in our days that we see the end of all suffering, the end of all plagues, the end of all craziness with Mashiach. All right.